long time ago. In fact, it's believed that they took place around the year 850 BC. And this was not a very good time in the history of Israel. So as many of you will know, the book of 2 Kings, it tells us a little bit about the history of Israel and some ways in which God worked in that history. And in fact, that was a very difficult time. I'm sure most of us will know that that the first king of Israel was, of course, King Saul, that's right. And after King Saul came King David. And then, of course, we had Solomon. And that was a glorious time, actually, in the time of King David. And in Solomon, the time of Solomon, the kingdom became very peaceful and very rich. And it seemed everything was going very well. But unfortunately, the story, even in Solomon's reign, things began to go down a little bit. And in fact, after Solomon, then the kingdom divided into two halves. The northern kingdom, which was in the Bible is still called Israel, and contained ten tribes, and the southern part called Judah, which had the other two tribes, and of course contained Jerusalem. And this story, in fact, is set in the northern part, in the northern kingdom of Israel. And the king at that time was somebody called King Joram, who was not a particularly good king. Well, he wasn't a very good king. And we'll pick up looking at verse 8 in 2 Kings. I should say that I had prepared a sermon actually based on Psalm 139, in fact, which is something we looked at in our house group this week. But in fact, I was at a meeting on Friday, a business meeting for the leaders in the Taking Ground churches in the northeast of England. And I just felt God really spoke to me in the course of that meeting through something that Martin Dunkley was saying. And I felt on account of that, I'm going to try and bring a message today that follows really from that. So if we've got 2 Kings, we're all there now, are we? 2 Kings chapter 6 and verse 8. Now the king of Aram was at war with Israel. After conferring with his officers, he said, "I will set up my camp in such and such a place." The man of God sent word to the king of Israel, "Beware of passing that place. The Arameans are going down there." So the king of Israel checked on the place indicated by the man of God, who, of course, was the prophet Elisha. And time and time again, Elisha warned the king so that he was on his guard in such places. I should say the king of Aram would be modern-day Syria. So that is, of course, they're coming down from the north to attack this northern kingdom. Okay. If we just flip forward a little bit to verse 13. So the king of Aram, in the meantime, had found that Elisha had been advising the king of Israel, and in verse 13, the king of Aram said, "Go, find out where he is, where Elisha is," the king ordered, "so that I can send men and capture him." The report came back, "He is in Dothan." Then he sent horses and chariots and a strong force there. Then they went by night and surrounded the city. And so that was the objective, to capture the prophet Elisha. And then on verse 15, "When the servant of the man of God," that's Elisha's servant, "got up and went out early the next morning, an army with horses and chariots had surrounded the city. 'O my Lord, what shall we do?' the servant asked." And I can imagine how daunting that would be. I don't know whether any of you have seen the film, The Return of the King, part of the Lord of the Rings films. Have any of you seen those? You should get out more, some of you, actually. It's a Anyway, there was a scene in the very end of that, well, in the middle of the third film, where indeed that something rather similar to that happened, and the king came out and stood on his battlements and saw this immense army surrounding his city, and it sort of the picture of it just brought it home, how daunting that could well have been. "What shall we do?" the servant asked. "Well, don't be afraid," verse 16, the prophet answered. "Those who are with us are more than those who are with them." And that's the first thing Elisha said. "Well, whatever you're going to do, don't be afraid. Just remember, those who are with us are more than those who are against us." And then Elisha prayed his prayers. Of all the prayers to pray at that time, it's interesting what he actually prayed. He just said, "Lord, open his eyes." He didn't sort of pray against the army surrounding all the soldiers. He just said, "Open the eyes of my servant." And what did the servant then see? He looked and saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. Now, I don't know quite how you visualize that, but the hills surrounded, the hills all around, full of horses and chariots. And it's interesting how you can have two perspectives on that story, isn't it? You can see, well, there's Elisha in the city being surrounded by an army or a group by soldiers. But actually the reality is those soldiers themselves are surrounded by a far greater army outside. In fact, it was the Arameans who were actually surrounded, not Elisha. So it's interesting that we have this picture of this heavenly host around surrounding everybody. And the challenge, of course, from that passage that's preached on quite often is really, what do you see? Well, we'll come back to that a little bit later. But that picture is true for us today. Remember in the Garden of Gethsemane, when Jesus was being arrested, you might recall actually that one of his disciples took out a sword and chopped off the ear of somebody with it, with that sword. Jesus said no. He says, don't you think I can call on my Father, he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels? You know, this heavenly host are still surrounding us. They were still surrounding Jesus at that time. They're still surrounding us today. Okay, well, that's the first passage that I'll refer to as I speak. The second passage starts at verse 24. Sometime later, Ben-Hadad, the king of Aram, who's believed to be the same king as the previous passage, he mobilized his entire army and marched up and laid siege to Samaria. And Samaria, in fact, was the capital of this northern kingdom. That was their equivalent, I suppose, of Jerusalem, you might say. He mobilized his entire army and he laid siege to Samaria. There was a great famine in the city. The siege lasted so long that a donkey's head sold for 80 shekels of silver and a quarter of a cab of seed pods for 5 shekels. So you've got this picture. I don't know what people felt. Here we go again. Sometimes life can feel that a little bit, can't it? You get through one thing and then something else crops up. Well, we've just read about one siege that, in fact, was relieved. But now, here we are a few verses later, the entire army comes back this time and lays siege to Samaria. And a donkey's head cost 80 shekels of silver. In case you're wondering, that's many hundreds of pounds in today's money. A shekel is actually 1 pound in weight. Two pounds in weight of... 80 shekels, excuse me, is 2 pounds in weight of silver. That's a lot of silver. It's an odd thing to say, isn't it? A donkey's head. Of all the things to talk about, a donkey's head seems a bit strange. And I suppose you'd say that if you wanted something, a donkey's head would not be really what you would want to eat. But even a donkey's head was going for hundreds of pounds. And that just shows how difficult life had become in this siege. And so then if we move to chapter 7 now, Elisha said, "Hear the word of the Lord. This is what the Lord says." And I just notice in passing that the word Lord, when you look at the Old Testament, you sometimes will see two words for Lord. One is just Lord, L-O-R-D with a capital L, and sometimes you have all four letters capitalized. There are and those reflect two different words that were used originally. If you see the word capitalized as it is here, then that would be the word that we would use Yahweh today. And of course you will, I'm sure, know the story of how God revealed himself to Moses in Exodus chapter 3 and verse 14, when he said, you know, my name is I Am. I am the God who exists, who exists eternally, I suppose. And that word was written down just using the consonants only, Y-H-Y-H. And that is the word that's translated Lord in capital letters in most English translations. As I said, in the original language, it only contains the consonants of a word. The other word, if you have Lord just with a capital L, that's Adonai, which just emphasizes the authority and the strength and the power of God. It sort of emphasizes our duty to really worship God and give him what he's due, because that's who he is. He's the one who's created us. But the word Lord in capital letters emphasizes relationship. In the mind of an Israelite at that time, it would have said, he is the God who has made his covenant with us. So this word Yahweh, to somebody at that time, would have represented the God who has his agreement with us. Okay, and that's and actually very often in the Old Testament you can see where two people have a conversation and one person uses one word and the other one uses another. That really shows they have different views of God. One is slightly more distant and one is emphasizing relationship, actually. But this time Elisha said, let's hear the word of the Lord, the one who has the covenant with us. This is what the Lord says: around this time tomorrow, a seah of flour will sell for a shekel, and two seas of barley for a shekel at the gate of Samaria. So in other words, he's saying that tomorrow that his head will not be valued. Everything will be back to normal again. Food will be plentiful. In verse 2, the officer on whose arm the king was leaning said to the man of God, look, even if the Lord should open the floodgates of heaven, could this really happen? Could this happen? A man who didn't believe what God had just spoken. Say, well, could God really do that? But and that's really how this officer responded. On this occasion, though, this would actually cost him dearly. As Elisha responded, you'll see it with your own eyes, but you will not eat any of it. And we then go on to read. I'll just go through this just briefly in outline. We actually flip from talking about this royal officer to talking about four lepers. So if you like, we're going right from the top of society right down to the bottom. Four lepers, they would be people who were maybe not even inside the city. They would be just right outside the gate. They would be ostracized. They would be separated from the other people for fear of catching the disease. So they would be a little bit in no man's land. But in fact, these lepers decided to go and see whether they could get any food in the camp of the enemy. And they went out in verses 5 onwards. They went out and they discovered that everybody was gone, that the enemy had actually left. And God, in fact, relieved that siege. He actually caused the enemy to leave. I won't go through the whole of that story, but God there producing deliverance exactly as he had promised. And they started off, as you might imagine, scoffing themselves worth of food and collecting gold and silver and hiding it for later. But eventually they came to their senses and said, no, we can't keep all of this to ourselves. And they went back to the city. And you can see the lack of faith that the king had. He didn't really believe what had happened. He said, it's a trap. I won't believe this. So he still didn't really believe what the prophet had said to him. But eventually he sent out a group of people just to explore and just check. And he found that indeed it really had happened, that God had done what he said. And in fact, the royal officer, what became of him in verses 17 to 20? The king put the officer on whose arm he had leaned in charge of the gate, and the people trampled him in the gate, and he died, just as the man of God had foretold. So he did indeed see it with his own eyes, but he didn't eat any of the food himself. So God actually did exactly what he said. So that's just quickly run through the passages. So now I'm going to start the proper preaching bit when I make some points from those. The first point I'm going to make, and this is what really provoked me in the meeting on Friday, when the prophet actually said, at this time tomorrow, a sea of flour will sell for a shekel. This word tomorrow. Now, I've told you my hope, my theme for the sermon was the God who gives us hope today, which it seems a bit odd because the verse I'm preaching from talks about tomorrow, not today. But actually, tomorrow was almost as good as today. You know, this is not a literary tomorrow. Life could be good tomorrow. He really did mean, you know, within 24 hours, this will be changed. And of course, the hope did come today as the prophet spoke. But the officer didn't believe him. Even if God opened his floodgates from heaven, could such a thing actually happen? But the answer, of course, is yes. It really did happen. And it really happened completely unexpectedly. You can imagine this siege had been going on, it says, for such a long time that this donkey's head was costing 80 shekels. And yet it changed just like that. And I think the challenge is sometimes life can be a bit like a siege. We can face difficulties and things can build up. And eventually we can ask ourselves, well, can God actually bring change or not? But the answer is God can bring change, absolutely. And God brought change in that situation. And it happened very suddenly and very unexpectedly. And the challenge is to remember who God actually is. When God speaks something, it really does happen. One of the jokes that we were having with Joshua and Carol actually was the difficulty in understanding what English people mean when they say something. And we're looking at various English phrases where one of them says, "I hear what you say." And there was a table, actually, you know, what the Englishman says, what people think he means and what he really means. So when someone says, "Well, I hear what you say," then it's easy to think, well, yes, that's right. He's agreeing with me. Of course, what he really means is, "I don't agree with you and I don't want to discuss it any further." That's true, isn't it? That's what that means. "Well, I hear what you say, but da-da-da-da-dum." But I think something else. But God isn't like that, actually. God isn't English. When God says something, he means exactly what he says. And everything that he says really does come true. And I think that, you know, in life, sometimes we can get very focused on what we see around us. But God's promises are absolutely reliable. And I think many of us here will be praying for things that we've been praying for many, many years. You know, I'm sure what I was actually provoked about was the salvation and those people we've been praying for to come to salvation and to come to know God for so many years. And it can be a little bit like being in a siege where eventually you can think, is this ever really going to happen? But the answer is yes, because God will honor every promise that he has made. And it's a very simple belief that we need to have in God there. We actually found that the king that didn't believe, and we've seen the consequence of unbelief. But actually, salvation is such a simple thing in a sense. It's so complicated, and yet it's so simple. And Martin was actually asking the question, can a man be saved in seven words? In nine words, sorry. Actually, I just had a quick thought. I thought, that isn't seven words, is it? Nine words. And Martin just referred briefly to this passage about the two thieves dying on the cross on either side of Jesus, where the thief just said, "Just remember me when you come into your kingdom." That's eight words. Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. Nine words. And I think there's something very powerful about that. And that person actually, and what did Jesus turn around? He said, "Truly I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise." The answer is yes. A man can be saved by saying nine words. Of course, he wasn't really saved by saying nine. He was saved because Jesus, of course, died on the cross. But sometimes things do happen very suddenly. Actually, my own story. Actually, when I became a Christian, I was at university. I'd been a student for 3 years. I was in my third year. I was sitting in the same seat in the lecture theatre that I've sat in every day throughout those 3 years. It's not only in church, you know, people sit in the same place. When you're a student, we sat in the same place in the lecture theatre. And my friend was sat next to me, my friend Kevin, who I'd met on the very first day I was at university. And actually, I knew that he was a Christian. And I just turned to him this day in the lecture and I said, "Well, Kevin, I've heard that there's this Christian mission that's going on in the university at the moment. And in the university, every year, there will be someone who would come and give a series of talks about the Christian faith." And I just said to him, "Well, do you fancy going this year?" And he said to me, "Well, yeah, let's go together. Come around to my place, we'll have some food, and then we'll go to this meeting afterwards." And actually, I did indeed go to that meeting, and I became a Christian that very night. That's amazing, isn't it? Apparently, out of nowhere, I found out afterwards that Kevin actually was one of the committee that was organising the mission. It's amazing, isn't it? He'd actually been praying for me actually for 3 years. And then suddenly, out of the blue, that happened. Now, of course, Kevin didn't really know what God was doing in my heart. I was absolutely in a terrible position, struggling against many things. I didn't let anybody else know about that, though. I kept that to myself. But actually, God had been working in me all that time. But to the outsider, no sign of that. I didn't say anything that would give him any encouragement at all. And yet at that moment, you know, God did something quite amazing. And I went to this meeting and there was someone who gave a really brilliant talk, and I can't remember a word of what this person said. And then there was just somebody else actually who just did a very simple little miming act. And this act was all just, it was talking about selfishness actually. And it was just at that point that God really spoke to me about my selfishness. And out of the middle of nowhere, actually, I just knew that I had to make a response to God. And God can sometimes work in amazing ways. And we have this tendency, don't we, as Christians, to always calculate and think how things could happen or who God is likely to work in. But in the Bible, of course, the most astonishing people became Christians. I mean, Paul himself, you know, the arch persecutor dragging Christians off to prison. You know, the jailer, the man who was keeping Paul in jail, he became a Christian and his whole household. We read about the centurion when Jesus himself said, this man's faith is amazing, the centurion. And absolutely amazing when you look through history, the different people who have become Christians. And we do all of our own thinking based on what we see. So in the previous church, actually, I ran a house group in the area of eastern Newcastle called Walker. And there was someone who came into the house group called Ed. That's all he ever called himself. He's a man of few words. He'd been worked in the shipyards for 40 years. He was very proud of his gold watch he got for his 40 years' work. Brought it in to show me. And he made a commitment, actually, but he was never able to quote 10 verses that would tell me what being a Christian meant to him. And somehow all he ever really said is, oh, him up there, well, he'll look after me. And that's all I could ever get out of him, really. But then eventually we left the big church in Newcastle, and of course we joined the church in Wickham. And I've often wondered, actually, you know, what happened to Ed after that? Because after I left that, then my house group, the church was restructured, and the house group was split into different parts. But actually last year, in fact, Ed died, who was then in his early 90s, and we were asked to go back to his funeral, of course. And so we met him and met his family again. And amazingly, actually, even when the group, which was on his doorstep, had closed, on his own effort, he'd actually continued to travel by bus from Walker into Newcastle and back every week in his 90s, which is, you know, that's a 10-mile bus journey. And because of obviously what his family had seen in his life, actually his niece and her two children had started going to church, actually. So God had put enough into his heart to transmit his faith to another generation. You know, you'd never have said that by looking at Ed and understanding him. But God works in very beautiful ways, actually. And I always think that that's a story we don't go by what we see. Now, of course, we can look at these people on the cross and you can do your theological analysis and you can say, well, yes, well, one thief said, you know, do you remember one thief cursed Jesus? And really, then he said, well, if you're God, then save yourselves and us. And then the other one said, no. We're getting what we deserve, but this man has done nothing wrong. Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And you can say, yes, well, he did acknowledge that he was getting what he deserved. He knew of his own sin, if you like. And yes, he knew that Jesus was the man who could save him when you come into your kingdom, actually. So he knew who Jesus was. So you could say, yes, he had his repentance and he had his faith, which is true. But yet it was just a very simple sentence of those 9 words. And then Jesus said, well, truly, I tell you today, you'll be with me in paradise. And if you go to Bible school, you'll be told that there's a lot of theological debate about where that comma is. Truly, I tell you, today you'll be with me in paradise, or truly, I tell you today, you will be with me in paradise. But most of the modern translations put the comma before the today. Today, you'll be with me in paradise. Is there anybody else who thinks there's something really beautiful about that story? There is something that's just so wonderful, isn't there? And, you know, when I think about that story, again, so unexpected. You know, everybody around Jesus is so hostile. The other man being crucified, hostile. And yet God just puts something into the heart of this one man unexpectedly. And I think back to my own conversion. I think, yes, you know, I would never have thought God is working in my life at that time, but he was. I mean, why on earth did I invite my friend to go to this mission meeting? Very strange. And God is working in people all the time, but we just can't see that. And what I'm saying is just trust in what God has said. And for those of us who are praying for people to come to faith, I'm sure many of us are in that position. Just remember those stories and just remember how God is so faithful to what he said. And these things can happen very suddenly. The God of hope, God gives us hope today, but even tomorrow, you know, the flood will be, the siege will be cleared away, and the food will be back at its normal price. So God is a God who gives hope and action today, and his promises are absolutely what he says. Right. And the second thing, I'll comment on this idea about what you see. Where am I here? What, What do we actually see? Of course, this is a point that's often made from that first passage. What do you see? And I've already talked about the story of Ed, again, who became a Christian unexpectedly. And yet God had done something very deeply, actually, in his heart. And God does sometimes do things which are unexpected and sometimes illogical. And we can't judge things by what we see. The Saviour who dies on a cross, Christ crucified, Paul says, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles, but to those who God's called, the power and the wisdom of God. God does things which sometimes there's something deeper that doesn't correspond to what you actually see. We see the Christmas story that we'll be going through in the next month about, you know, how Jesus, of course, he was the King and the Messiah, yet he was born in a manger. We read in Isaiah that he had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him. There was nothing in his appearance we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men. You see, when you judge by the things that you see, you sometimes absolutely miss the point, don't you? And Elisha said to his servant, the prayer he actually prayed was, Lord, open up his eyes so that he can see. And he saw all these chariots and the whole host of God surrounding them. In fact, they were perfectly safe. And in fact, the same thing is true for us. I've mentioned Jesus talking about him having this legion of angels at his call. Another story where Jesus actually talked about the angels who surround little children. He said, say you don't despise one of these little ones. He said, they're angels in heaven. Always see the face of my Father. And I think the heavenly host and God's provision is close to every one of us today. But how we actually see things actually really drives our life, because when you see things, it generates our thoughts, and when you begin to think about things, that leads to the way in which you behave and the things that you do. So there's a number of very important people in the Old Testament. I'll just read out their names. So the names are Shammah, Shaphat, Igal, Palti, Gadiel, Gadi, Amiel, Sether, Nabi, and Goyal. Does anybody know who they are? These are important leaders, actually. There were 10 names. Does that give anybody a clue? 10 tribes, yes, but... Yeah, so... Sorry? No, okay, it's a tough question. The two that were missing, there were actually another two, of course. The two that was missing, one was Joshua and the other one was Caleb. That's right. So these were the ten spies. I think spies is a bit of a negative word. Maybe 10 scouts would be a good, better word to describe them, that Moses sent to have a look around the promised land. He chose 12 people, 12 leaders, actually. So these people were not fools. These were responsible leaders in the community, actually. Well, maybe they were fools in the end, but they were people who were leaders. And they both they and Joshua and Caleb came back with their reports. The 10 said, well, yes, this is a great land, but we'll never get it. It's too hard for us. The other two said, it's a great land. We should go there and get it, for we can certainly do this. And it's just very interesting to see what they actually saw about this land. So there's a famous saying, actually. This is something said by a blind person who actually said, when someone said to her, is there anything worse than not having sight? And she said, yes, it's having sight but having no vision. And I think there can be something really depressing about life where even if you can see things around you, but you have no vision at all as to what those things actually mean. And in the case of Elisha and his prophet, well, and his servant, sorry, then the servant's eyes were opened and he finally could actually see the reality of the situation surrounding him. Very often, of course, we are in a position where we don't see all of that. But God, of course, does give us a vision as to what he's doing. You know, and I think sometimes, you know, when you look at our family life and you look at the things that we face, we can sometimes focus so much on the last thing somebody said to me, and we think so much about that. You know, but God's purposes go through generations, and you know, God's purposes for people are over many, many years, not over that last little event that took place. And you know, I think when we look at the things that we're doing in this church, you know, you can look at our messy church, you know, and it's great that we had about 20 children with us last Saturday. And it's great in Rangers when you can see all the children hollering around and splashing around in the forest in the mud. It's great when you see that, but of course you've got to see that those young lives can be changed. You know, those, you could be looking at individuals whose lives are changed and transformed by God. And you could be looking in the future at 30 families there who honour God. I mean, 30 families who honour God in this area, that would transform the area, wouldn't it, actually? You know, and I think God works his purposes in all of these lives and through all of these things that we're doing. And it's so important just to have that vision for what God would have us do and for what God does through the things that we do. I'll just read out just a few verses that emphasise God's purposes and God's provision surrounding us. So I'll just read out... Where am I? Here we are. So maybe I'll just read out a few verses from the psalm I was going to speak about. Psalm 139. There we go. So it says, "Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me, and the light become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you." Again, beautiful verses, aren't they? Where shall I go? Where shall I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, these are words that are often on posters, aren't they? If I settle on the far side of the sea, even there, your hand will guide me. You can't escape that presence of God. It surrounds us all the time. Is that what you see? Do we see that presence of God surrounding us? Because that actually is the reality. You know, we can't see that with our eyes always. Sometimes we see something that results from that, but we don't actually see that presence of God surrounding us. But his presence is with us all the time. "Even there your hand will guide me, your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me and the light become night around me." Sometimes we feel a bit like that, don't we? Where difficult circumstances push in around us. "And yet even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day." See, when you're with God, even if you're in a time of darkness, his light prevails and his light shines. We need fear no evil, for God is with us. Just read out another famous psalm. This is the Psalm 91 that says, "He who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will rest in the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, he is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in whom I trust." I'll just move to verse 9. "If you make the Most High your dwelling, even the Lord who is my refuge, then no harm will befall you. No disaster will come near your tent. For he will command his angels concerning you to guard you in all your ways, so that they will lift you up in their hands. You will not strike your foot against a stone. You will tread on the lion and the cobra. You'll trample the great lion and the serpent." Even in darkness, in difficulty, that will be as light to God. "Because he loves me, says the Lord, I will rescue him and I will protect him, for he acknowledges my name. He will call on me and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver him and honour him. With long life I will satisfy him and show him my salvation." And I'll just amazing words, just that promise and that presence of God around us, protecting us, blessing us, and guarding us. So let's just put that together just to come to a close. So I've said that God is a God who gives us hope today. we read the story of the siege that had been going on for a very long time, with this famous donkey's head costing 80 shekels. And yet God says, well, tomorrow that will all be taken away. And when God brings that change in a human life, it does happen sometimes that very, very quickly. And I can identify myself with this royal officer that says, well, even if God opens up his floodgate, could such a thing truly happen? But what I'm saying to you this morning is the answer is yes, that could indeed happen. And that's the God that we need to have our faith on and our eyes focused on day by day. Because it's easy actually to have sight and to have no vision. That's such an easy thing to happen to every one of us. What I'm saying is let's keep our eyes fixed on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, as it says in Hebrews. Let's keep our eyes fixed on God and his provision, and let's just trust in those promises that God has given to us. And I'll just say that even though we might not have seen things for many years, God can bring change just tomorrow, and we need to live in that hope and in that vision. Even if we don't see that today, tomorrow could be a very different day, and it could be literally tomorrow. You know, tomorrow doesn't always mean in 1,000 years' time. Tomorrow can mean tomorrow. And that's how I'll finish. So thank you very much.